I want to welcome you all. Thank you for coming out. My name is Jeremy Del Rio. I'm from New York City. And this workshop, if you couldn't tell from the background, is Adopt a School, an Idea Whose Time Has Come. Before we get into, though, the content of the presentation, if it's all right with you, I'm going to ask that you indulge me for a minute to tell a little story about one of the young people that I know. He's a teenage boy, like lots of teenagers, who's struggling really hard to fit in. He kind of blurs into the background. There's not a whole lot that distinguishes himself, except that he's studious and he works with his stepdad from time to time in construction. But other than that, you know, he's really struggling to fit in because he's a recent immigrant to the community. And as an immigrant, the challenge he's had isn't so much learning the language. He knows the language, but the customs of the kids in his community, the slang words, you know, the posture, all the things that indicates that you fit in, that you belong, that you're part of the cool crowd. He's struggling really hard to get with that. But even worse than that is his family has some history in this community. And ever since he's moved in, it seems like there's this cloud that hangs over his family. And people can get real cruel sometimes, right? He overhears them talking about him. Sometimes the kids in particular, they can get really nasty and in his face. And he just is struggling really hard to figure out why. And he gets angry because it's unfair. It's unjust. He wants to fight back. But mom won't let him. She tells him, she promises that someday it'll make sense. But for right now, it just hurts. And so he likes to go off and reflect and figure out what's going on here. Why is it that wherever I've lived, it's been difficult for me to fit in? You see, the reason before he immigrated to this community, he lived in a political refugee camp. He was a refugee because the community where he was born was ruled by one of these tyrannical dictators that would do really wicked things at the drop of a hat. And in fact, as a little boy, they survived bloodshed, a massacre in their community. And as a result of that, he became this refugee. This teenage friend of mine, you might actually know him because he's no longer a nameless and faceless teenager. If you grew up in Sunday school or as a youth worker, perhaps you've preached about him. We call him Jesus Christ. And when I think about the story of Jesus and the way that he became flesh and blood and moved among the neighborhood, I take lots of comfort as an urban youth worker because I know a lot of kids just like that Jesus. I know a lot of kids that are struggling to fit in, struggling to figure out where they belong, struggling to understand. And when you think about his life, right, the manner in which he came. Yeah, he grew up as a teenage boy in the ghetto. We know it was the ghetto because the reputation recorded in Scripture about Nazareth was that no good thing came from that place. Those are the reputations that are imposed from outside on communities very much like the ones that we minister in, right? So he grows up there, but when you think about it, God decides he's going to become flesh and blood and move into the neighborhood. So he impregnates a teenage girl. Now, this was not 21st century Los Angeles, 21st century New York City, 21st century Chicago. This was first century Palestine at a time when unmarried pregnancy was a capital crime. Jesus invites stigma to cover him the rest of his days. Not only does he do that, he impregnates his girl who's not married. But you think about Joseph, right? The reputation Joseph had was a man of honor. Matthew tells us in Matthew chapter 1 that Joseph was acknowledged by his community as a man of honor. Well, that distinction didn't just happen. Right, people didn't wake up one morning with the reputation of being honorable. In that cultural context, honor was something that a family had to work for generations. And after generations of assembling a reputation, they were regarded as ones with honor. Well, when Joseph decided to claim that boy as his son, what do you think happened to the honor of his family name? He invited dishonor and shame to walk with him. And then what happens, right? Mary's pregnant and it's time. She's been pregnant now for 8 or 9 months. She's towards the end. So God arranges a special location for birth and specifically requires this woman who's pregnant at the end of her pregnancy to travel 100 miles in the desert on a donkey. Not exactly the most hygienic or safe or optimal birthing conditions, right? And where do they go? To a barn? When my wife was pregnant and we were considering birthing facilities, the Prospect Park Petting Zoo in Brooklyn, that was nowhere near our list of options. And yet God invites his son to be born surrounded by sheep and goat and donkeys and all of the things that accompany those places. I'm a city guy. I didn't grow up on a farm, but I've been to enough petting zoos to know that they smell bad, right? That they're dirty, that there's lots of people, not people, but things flying around that feed off of waste deposits and then they come and they rest on you, right? And it's all kind of nasty and gross. Well, Jesus was born in that context. And when I think about that, the stigma he invited, the circumstances of his life, the place where he grew up, the context of his, of what it meant for him to be flesh and blood and live on, in our neighborhoods, I'm reminded of the kids in my ministry and specifically the kids in our public schools. I'm going to share with you our journey towards this idea. It's not an original idea. I didn't trademark Adopt a School. I mean, it's kind of interesting. There are multiple workshops going on around similar themes, working with school systems, Christology in schools, all sorts of stuff, right? So this is hardly an original idea. I don't claim it as my own, but it's one that has captivated the imagination of youth workers in New York City. And so if it's okay with you, I'm going to share our journey. Not as something prescriptive for you all to go back and figure A plus B equals C and do it exactly the same way, but just kind of share the story of what's happening in New York. Perhaps it can inspire, perhaps it can ignite some of your own thinking about how to engage schools. It began for us in New York with a basic question, right? New York City has 1.2 million students in the public school system. By themselves, that's the 10th largest city in America, right? The school, there are 2 million young people 18 and under in the five boroughs, which by themselves is the fifth largest city. But the overwhelming number of them congregate in our public schools. In New York, that kind of begs the question. If Jesus calls us to be fishers of men, and the fish are literally congregating for us in schools, not just figuratively in schools, but literally, they're in the schools, are we in the schools? And so for us, it began with this question. What might happen if the 7,100 evangelical, Pentecostal, and charismatic churches in New York City, and then you can, you know, go beyond that, but that's the number we know for that particular constituency. What might happen if 7,100 churches adopted 1,400 public schools? If people from the churches began to pray for the schools, began to volunteer within the schools as hall monitors, class assistants, tutors, event organizers, PTA delegates, coaches, what might happen if church students were empowered to be salt and light on the campuses? What might happen if the staff members from those schools who attended our churches were equipped to recognize their profession as a calling? Not just a job they get paid for, but I'm a teacher, I'm a secretary, I'm a custodian, I'm a principal, and I'm strategically placed in this community, surrounded by young people. What might happen if they saw that as a ministry vocation. Not just a career, but an opportunity to engage with young people. Dare we expect that God would actually be God? Right? Doesn't he say, prove me, test me, come to me with faith? Right? If 7,100 churches in our city began to pray and engage on a campus level, dare we expect that God might actually show up? That test scores may actually improve. We're going to get into that in a minute. That the multiple billions of dollars that the Department of Ed spends on education might actually produce some results. Might be spent better, more wisely, with greater effect. Dare we expect that our young people would be equipped to be who God made them? Newsflash for us youth workers, right? When we get up and we preach the greatest sermon ever, and we encourage our kids to go back and test it in the Word, if they're not reading at grade level, it doesn't matter how great your message, because they're not going to be able to go back and get into the Word the way that we expect or that God expects. The understanding and comprehending His love letter, right? The historical context of the story, getting into it. If you're functionally illiterate, that's really not an option. And so when our kids come on the other end of school, unable to perform those kind of tasks, they're ill-equipped to be who God has called them to be. So in New York City, I already mentioned there are 7,100 of these churches. That's nearly 7 churches for every school. Now, in your communities, the math might be a little bit different, but just so that you know, nationwide, there are supposedly 300,000 evangelical churches. I don't know if you add Pentecostal and Catholic and Charismatic and all the rest. I just know there are 300,000, supposedly, according to sociologists that count this kind of thing. There are 300,000 churches, and there are approximately 100,000 public schools. So nationwide, it's still a 3-to-1 ratio. Just when you count evangelicals, not, you know, with the exclusion of all those other groups. So the numbers are still overwhelming. If you had 7 churches engaging, or 3 churches, right? If you, in New York, if you add all the private schools, the parochial schools, etc., there's an additional 1,000. You still have about the same ratio as we have nationwide, 3-to-1. So if there are that many opportunities, what might actually unfold? For us in New York, I mentioned the opportunity. 2 million young people. That's the 5th largest city in America. It's 1/4 of New York City's population. The percentages are pretty consistent nationwide. So the numbers may not be the same, but the percentages are roughly the same. That roughly 1/4 of our population is under the age of 18. Right? In New York, there are almost 500,000 15 to 19 year olds. By themselves, that's the 35th largest city. And here again in New York, they exert disproportionate influence because of the media focus of our city. But in your community, what does that look like? Right? Each one of our communities are different. They have a different vibe. They've got different strengths. They've got different impact that gets felt beyond our particular neighborhood or beyond our region and our cities. And so think about how your students are affecting not just the context of their schools, but the larger community, the families, the economics of the neighborhood, the social fabric of the community. What does that look like in your community? But the greatest part about the opportunity is that at-risk children are near God's heart. Right? They're closer to God's heart, I believe, than anybody else. Why do I say that? Because Jesus said things like, "Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these." Who's more like a child than a child? Right? He said, the kingdom belongs to children and people who are like children. People who are able to embrace this this nature of a kingdom that's so much different than how we typically operate. He said, kids are especially dear to God's heart. I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of these least brothers of mine, you did for me. Jesus so identifies with these communities that he says, if you bless them, you blessed me. I mean, and it comes not just some academic theoretical construct, right? Because he became one of those kids like we talked in the beginning. He was literally one of those at-risk marginalized young people that he now invites us to love. And he says when we love them, when we go out of our way, when we engage with them on their turf, in their language, it's as if we're loving him. So, what does this look like in New York City? In New York City, there are 563,000 kids who live below the poverty line. That's the 25th largest city. Everything's bigger in New York. That's why they call it the Big Apple, right? So, there are 500,000 young people that live below the poverty line in New York. I don't know what the numbers are in your communities, but this is how we've kind of processed through the challenge for us. If God's heart is for the least, the last, and the lost, like we heard Larry say at some point, he says that all the time, right? If God's heart is for the least, the last, and the lost, and I know that there are 500,000 young people below the poverty line, and that our context, our cultural context in America is, go get an education and you'll be set up for life, right? And we promise those 500,000 poor kids that the education they're going to receive is going to equip them for a better life. And then we fail to deliver on it systematically. What are we saying to those kids? Right? So we've got this massive population of poverty. 72% of Latino and 61% of African American children live in the poor families in America. I mean, in New York City. So it's not only is there like this class issue of the poor kids versus the more wealthy school districts, but it's predominantly ethnic communities that are stuck in generational poverty in our city. And so are we prepared to go there in our community? Again, I don't know the numbers in your neighborhoods, but this is part of our experience. Being flesh and blood and moving into the neighborhood requires getting in there, getting educated, identifying what the issues are. And this is how we've done it for us. In this context, in New York City, 2 million young people, the harvest is plentiful and the laborers are overwhelmingly few. As an example, you know, nobody's done this scientific research, but anecdotally, I can tell you that when the Billy Graham Crusade came to New York 2 years ago, we hosted a breakfast that 787 youth workers attended from the greater New York area. That's a pretty significant sample size, right? 787 youth workers. When one of the speakers got up, he asked, how many of them were full-time, paid, professional youth workers? And if 36 hands were raised, it's a lot, right? Then, of course, the next question was, how many of you are bivocational volunteers? You got a day job and you do this because you're called, but you might not be well funded. And it was everybody else. Everybody else stood up. So what that tells me is, if we're going to be realistic about engaging the schools where 1.2 million people are, our paradigm for youth ministry has to move beyond the professional paid youth worker, youth pastor, parachurch worker, right? It's got to move beyond that. And that's why this is, for us, the opportunity that's grabbed a hold of our imagination. And so what's happening? What are the results of that $12 billion education budget that's educating all of these kids? 6 in 10 high school students will not graduate with a high school diploma. 6 in 10 elementary school students cannot read at grade level. Now, this is New York. And I'm giving you our experience in New York. I said this in the beginning for the benefit of those who came in a little bit late. Just as a framework for how we've begun to think through the issue. And in your particular community, the numbers might look a little different. The particular needs might be a little bit different. But it's helpful to really wrap your arms around the totality of the issue. We know that Jesus loves individuals. He doesn't love statistics. But I can't imagine Jesus spending much time in a statistics class in grad school. He wasn't about the numbers. He was about the people. But for us, this has helped us to put the scope of the challenge before the people. 7 in 10 can't perform basic math computations. What does that mean? Those numbers are sort of abstract and not particularly meaningful. Kids who can't read, they can't do Bible studies. They can't complete job applications. They're disadvantaged when it comes to receiving the opportunities that our country promises them, that our cities and our culture promises them, that many of our teachers promise them, that our athletes promise them. I remember growing up, the NBA had, you know, their campaign was stay in school, it's your best move. And I remember watching that as a teenager thinking, that's great, you know, I've got a great family and good educational opportunity. Sure, that's a no-brainer for me. But for the kids in the neighborhood, 2 plus 2 didn't always equal 4, right? Because when mom was strung out on crack and big brother was slinging the dope that mom was buying and the sister was pregnant, who really cared that 2 plus 2 equal? You know, like, that's who's George Washington? George Washington's completely irrelevant in that context. And so for us, when the system isn't educating our kids and we're not meeting them, that means they can't read at grade level, they can't conduct Bible studies, they can't complete job applications in a way that's competitive with some of their peers that are better educated. Kids who can't do math, right? They can't balance a checkbook or budget a household, right? If I don't understand basic math principles, then it's hard for me to understand why the $150 pair of sneakers that I bought last month doesn't need to be replaced. Right? Because all I'm not really doing the math and figuring it out, but I'm allowing other influences to shape and inform those decisions. Kids who don't graduate have a much harder time getting and keeping jobs and much more likelihood to end up in the criminal justice system. So for us, how do we engage, right? We see the need. We see this vast pool of people that God loves. We see the opportunity and the shortcomings that are being perpetuated that need to be addressed. So how do we go about actually engaging with that system? There are some things for us to consider. The first is to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. I'm tired of Christians that think the only way to communicate Christ is to pull out an AK-47, you know, and do some sort of drive-by. That's not the only way to do Christ, to be Christ. That's not being flesh and blood living in the neighborhood. If we're going to engage a public school system, we've got to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Public schools are non-religious institutions. If we have a problem with that, this is not an appropriate strategy. Because they're non-religious, we have to learn how to speak Babylonian. Right? The paradigm for this kind of engagement is not, you know, David building Jerusalem. It's Daniel engaging Nebuchadnezzar, right? Daniel, the Bible tells us Daniel mastered the arts of that culture. That included sorcery, right? Think about it. Daniel did stuff that we would find so offensive, but he had to in order to rise to the level of influence where he was able to have the kind of impact that he had. Esther and Daniel, you know how far they went in being able to engage? They didn't even go by their Hebrew names. They took on Babylonian names so that they, and Persian names so that they would fit into that context, speak the language and be part of it. And we have to be able to translate truth in that kind of way that it speaks to people where they are. It requires a paradigm shift for some, especially in the evangelical community. The Department of Education is not the enemy. In fact, they're an ally for us to equip our kids to be who God has called them to be. Right? God, we know. I mean, we're all youth ministers. We preach it. God's got a plan and purpose for our kids' lives, right? He's got gifts that He's deposited in them, and it's their job to steward those gifts so they can flourish and be fruitful and multiply and all the wonderful things that Scripture promises. Well, the schools are allies in that, because the schools, when they're doing their job, they're giving kids the capacity to think. Jesus says, "Love me with all your mind," doesn't He? You can't love them with all your mind if you don't know how to think critically, if you don't know how to engage difficult subject matter. Well, schools, when they're doing their job, help kids do that. And it's on us to recognize them as an ally. The goal then has to become bigger than the typical evangelical goals, right? For decades, we've reduced the conversation around school reform to school prayer and vouchers. Now, I believe in school prayer, but let me clue you in, if I'm sure you know this already. Anybody who tells you that people can't pray in public schools, they're either woefully misinformed and therefore ignorant, or they're outright lying and trying to manipulate you. The only prayer that's outlawed in schools is that non-denominational, meaningless 30-second kneel down thing that, you know, has no impact anyway. That's what's outlawed. But our kids, they're definitely empowered to pray. They can pray officially in some sort of school-sanctioned Bible club, and they can pray unofficially when they're walking up and down the hallways, and they're in the lunchroom, and they're communicating with their friends, and they're taking a test. Our teachers, they can certainly pray. Maybe not in leading a classroom, again, in that non-denominational prayer, but there's nothing holding them back from praying. And so we've got to move the conversation beyond that that straw man. It's a non-issue. It's a nullity. And so let's get past that and recognize that we not only can pray, but we're obligated to pray. And you do all the praying you need to do. And stop bickering about the non-denominational nonsense. That's not impactful anyway. As far as vouchers, I think vouchers are a great thing personally. But I know that in my city, if we had vouchers, there aren't enough private schools for 2 million kids. Period. So you institute vouchers, that's terrific. All you're going to do is create more headaches for everybody because they're going to have fewer options and feel more frustrated. And so we got to get past that, that narrow, myopic kind of argument about reform. The fact is, we've got this institution that's already been established. And if we would begin to engage that institution, not only with prayer, but meaningful service and systemic reform, God has given us that opportunity and that obligation. Because when we're in that space, in this way, He promises to answer our prayers. So for us in New York, we've begun this adoptive school by encouraging churches simply to pray intentionally. That's just the first step. That's the tip of the iceberg. But it's our conviction that if you actually engage in prayer about a subject, God pulls your heart, right? It's hard to really pray about a person or about a place and not get a heart for that person or that place. And so we want to begin there. God answers prayer, but it's also a tool He uses to get people's heart where it needs to be. And so when we talk to churches about praying, we say it's good to understand the landscape, do the research, understand the numbers, but move past the statistics. Get a name and a face. Right? For pastors, when we talk to the pastors, say, think about that kid that the ushers can't control on Sunday. Right? And if you know the face, which undoubtedly you have a face, but you don't know the name, don't ask somebody to find out their name. Go and introduce yourself to the kid. Right? Develop that relationship so you can begin to pray intentionally about those kids. Oftentimes, right, when we pray for people, we pray for these on top, the rebellious kid, the ones who are obviously difficult to handle. Or we pray for those kids that blend in the background, right? And here again, we're encouraging pastors and whoever's on the prayer team that's committed to this to get names and faces to go with it, the weak ones. But sometimes we overlook these, right? The high achievers. But the fact of the matter is, high achievers have a greater tendency to become self-reliant. If you get the job done, you got people telling you how great you are, you've got opportunities that present themselves, it's easy to lose that realization that I'm totally dependent on God. It becomes that much easier to do. And so we want them to be praying intentionally for the high achievers as well. The second thing, we move beyond just praying for specific youth, but also praying for those community struggles, right? Things like the family disintegration, things like the gangs and the drugs and the crime, things like sexuality, right? There's so many kids that are struggling with this issue. So many of them that are just confused. And they're confused. Yes, the media has a significant impact, and we'll actually talk about that in the MOOCs Midriffs workshop after this one. But leaving that aside, at the end of the day, most of our kids, they just want to be loved, right? And a kid, I can tell you from experience, every girl that I know that's struggling with bisexuality or lesbianism that has come out of our youth group, every single one of them, right? Every one of them has all they've been pursuing for as long as I've known them is somebody that's going to love them unconditionally. And most of them have been through situations where dad was absent or disengaged, where boyfriend after boyfriend has mistreated them, rejected them, left them on the side, and they're just looking for affection. Right, our kid. And so we get into like all this politicized stuff about sexuality. No, man, these are real kids with real hearts that God loves, and we have to begin to communicate that kind of stuff. But beyond just the community thing and the individual lives, what are the systemic issues, right? There are system breakdowns that allow public schools to spend billions of dollars and for decades produce so little results. There are system breakdowns for the fact that 71% of Latino children in New York live in poor families. That doesn't just happen. And we've got to get beyond that. And so we begin to pray intentionally about that. Some of them, you know, things that get overlooked sometimes, all the poverty pimps, right? Who are poverty pimps? There's so many of them. So many, like on every level. Some are the politicians that only show up when it's time to get votes. And they say the things that'll tickle people's ears, but then they're gone as soon as they're reelected to office. You never hear from them again. Sometimes it's the nonprofits, right, that take the pictures to raise the money and then don't produce the results. Sometimes if you saw Business Week this week, had an expose, a feature article talking about how finance companies are systematically targeting poor communities, charging them higher rates of interest, and defaulting faster on their loans. Systematically going after these communities. So there's so many different layers of this kind of stuff. But it's not just, it's not just the community issue. It's systems that have allowed that to perpetuate. And so begin to pray against that. Pray towards commission. It's not just praying against all the time, but also praying for something productively. And in this case, it's commissioning our churchgoers to be who God has called them to be in the marketplace, in the school system, whether they're teachers, their employees, or their students, right? To recognize their role in that space as a ministry calling. And it's not just in the schools too, mind you, right? It's the business owners. I wish that the sneaker company, the sneaker stores in the neighborhood, Imagine if the business managers, the store managers, the sneaker companies saw their role not just as an entrepreneur, but also as a youth minister. You know, and the empowerment that would give to the extent they hire kids, right? They're hiring our kids all the time. They usually fire them shortly after and have like that revolving door system. But what if they viewed that as a mentoring opportunity? You know, if they viewed that as a job skills development opportunity, what if they saw the fact that these kids that keep coming in and paying $150 for a pair of sneakers, you know, there's something's not computing. Yeah, it might be bad in the short term for their bottom line to discourage a kid from buying a new pair of sneakers after they just had one. But in the long run, the community trust and all that would build up, right? Pray for the reform advocates as well, the people that are beating the drum and championing the cause within our communities. I want to move towards some discussion, but before we do, I want to offer two specific case studies of churches in New York that have embraced this thing, this thought process. The first is a project-based approach that actually a denomination has gotten behind. The Southern Baptists, for the last 3 or 4 years in New York City, they've had a short-term missions thing that they call Paint the Town. And what Paint the Town was for 3 years is they get like 1,000 Southern Baptists from Mississippi and Arkansas and Alabama that wanted to do short-term missions in New York. And so the project that they would do when they'd come was to go and paint public schools. They worked it out with the city that, you know, these chronically underdeveloped school buildings would get beautified. And that was this project. Well, last year when we started beating the drum about Adopt a School, the executive director of the Metro New York Baptist Association saw one of the articles that was written, and right away he began to think, is it possible to take advantage of Paint the Town and leverage it so that local churches could begin ongoing relationships with the school? So it's not just the Mississippi volunteer that's coming in, you know, painting the room and then leaving at the end, but that this resource might become, a leverage point for a local congregation to begin some relationship. And so last year, they pioneered that with a church called Crossroads Church in Staten Island. So this became a catalyst for them. And the church did some really incredible things because they recognized that it was more than just that summer missions opportunity if they could leverage that. So some of the things that they implemented, they started again with prayer. They did prayer watches. They did prayer walks. They had small group prayer. So at every level of the church, they began to bathe the opportunity in prayer. But then they developed relationship with the school. They prepared real simple things, a letter, you know, a little packet explaining the opportunity. And the pastor of the church went to the school personally and handed the letter both to the custodian and to the principal. So it's real simple. Nothing, this isn't like rocket science. But he wanted to make sure that the people at the school level that might either embrace or reject the opportunity both knew, but also that they'd have a face. It wouldn't just be an impersonal letter. So he comes, he drops it off. Then he, on the church level, he begins to build the team, cast a vision, recruit volunteers. It became an intentional focus for this church. Their attitude was, yeah, we've got all the Mississippi volunteers. We're going to leverage them, but let them be a support. We want the church to really own this. And so they worked on investing in the team, casting vision. But then this is where he got real, real brilliant as far as I'm concerned. He looked at the relationship with the school as a resume of trust. That was his approach. He said, I have no credibility with this school, but I'm just some dude off the street. Yeah, we're going to come and paint the building. But if we want this to go beyond the beautification project, we have to give them some reason to trust us. And so they began to do really simple things. Right? So one of the things they did, they sponsored, the church sponsored a teacher appreciation breakfast. Nothing fancy. What did that mean for them? A couple of the church members went out, 7 o'clock in the morning, bought bagels and coffee and donuts, and they were there in the teacher's lounge as teachers were arriving before the students and just giving them food and being friendly. And you know what the teacher's response was? Shock. Because they get criticized all the time, but nobody ever comes in to say thank you or to bless them. And so the teachers began to appreciate this. They did it specifically at strategic points in the school year. The end of the year. They were there the last day of school and the first day of the new school year. They wanted the teachers to see them, one of their last memories before the summer break, being this church that loved them and served them. And then one of their first memories when they came back, we're still here, we're still loving you, we're still serving you. Real simple, right? Not a particularly profound concept. Then they went to the PTA and they got permission to cast vision for the project. And so what they did as part of this, I might be going a little bit out of order, right? But they went, they cast vision of the PTA, and one of the things they wanted to do as part of the paint campaign in the summer was to have like a schoolyard barbecue, right? So that the volunteers would be fed, but also so the community could celebrate what was going on. And what they discovered, they thought when they were planning the schoolyard barbecue that all the church people were going to have to own that and work the grills and buy the burgers and stuff. And the PTA stepped up. They said, no, we'll take care of the barbecue. And so it went beyond the church, beyond the Mississippi volunteers, to the people in the community beginning to own it and engage it. They did things to generate relationship with the principal, like taking her to lunch, having appreciation opportunities. They began to do recreational activities with the students. And what's happened, right? So that was last year. They catch the vision for adopting the school. The denomination has this ongoing project that's sort of floating out there out of context. Great thing. The denominational leader catches the vision and says, we want to support it. And so they pilot it with just one church last year. And you know what they did this year? First of all, that church is a church plant. Last year, they were able to paint two entire school buildings with this project, right? So they totally painted two school buildings. This year, they've outgrown their space. And so they needed a new location. They ended up becoming the first church ever in the history of Staten Island to be able to rent a school auditorium and move their church. So they're actually meeting now in a public school utilizing the facility. It's not one of the schools they painted last year, but the principal called right away, those two principals. The testimony was so great, they welcomed them in, and now this summer they're painting that school where they're meeting. So they're doing it again, right? But what happened on a denominational level, I'm not Baptist, so I'm not getting paid for this, right? But I have mad respect for what they've been doing with this project. About 3 months ago, this executive director who read the article, who did this pilot last year, he called me up and he said, Jeremy, the denomination wants to do this and really get behind it. So this year for Paint the Town, we're giving 10 mini grants to churches that are already engaged in relationships at school. And out of the 10, we want to reserve 3 for non-Baptist congregations. Have you ever heard of that? Like, I was blown away when he said that. And he said, and furthermore, we're going to hold 3 of them for non-Baptist groups. We want to invest in that specifically so they can leverage like Crossroads has done. And we want to track it all summer, the impact, so that at the end of in the fall of next year, we can apply for significant funding to do adopt a school systematically throughout the city and empower, you know, churches and youth ministers to begin to do this. It blew me away to see their response to this. Another one. I'm going to give one more case study, which is a little more personal to me, Right? I've been involved in ministry since I was a little kid. My parents are, you know, preachers, and back in 1982, when I was 8 years old, they started Abounding Grace Ministries as a street evangelism ministry, based on this really literal interpretation of Romans 5:20, which is where sin abounds, grace abounds much more. They wanted God's grace in their evangelism, so they asked the NYPD where the worst drug spots were in New York, figuring if they found a lot of drugs, they'd find a lot of sin, and by extension, experience God's abounding grace. So that's how I got initiated into ministry. 10 years later, in 92, they planted a church in the same community where the police had directed us a decade earlier. In 94, I was still in college, and my dad kind of drafted me to start the youth ministry. You know, it was very reminiscent of Harvey Carey's description last night of how you just kind of get drafted into it. Don't know, you're not equipped or anything else, but we start this youth group. In 96, I was this, you know, we went through this phase in the youth ministry where everybody hit the wall at the same time. You ever been there? Right? We had all these kids that came to faith. They were in love with Jesus. And then the infatuation ended. And they all hit the wall, and all of a sudden, I felt like a complete failure as a youth pastor. Didn't matter what I presented, didn't matter how creative or fun our activities got. They were disengaged. I thought they were all a bunch of rebellious, you know, hoodlums. And it was like, it was a mess. And in the middle of that, one of the guys from the church sits me down and he says, "Jeremy, you need to share your heart. Just get, you know, scrap your agenda, sit in a circle and share your heart and invite them to do the same." And as we did that night, what came back to me was, it's not that we want less, it's that we want more. Didn't matter how much the church was open, how many midweek prayer meetings they attended, Bible studies, youth group meetings, Sunday services. You know, it didn't matter if they came to every men's fellowship, women's fellowship, whatever it was, if they came to everything in a given week, at most, it might be 12 hours or 15 hours. And their point to me was, what do we do when the church isn't open? You know, where do we go after school? Where do we go in the summertime? We want a safe space. And so we started this journey, 13 of the kids and myself. I was 21 and this failure as a youth pastor, the oldest one involved in this project, and 13 kids decide they're going to start a youth center. And so we had no money, no space, no equipment, no paid staff, failure as a youth pastor, you know, rebellious kids, and we decided we were going to start a youth center. Not exactly the prescription for how you get that done. Long story short, 5 months later, we had a fully furnished space in the projects down the street, and we had 7 college students that paid to work for us. And we opened in the summer of 96. Well, we were right across the street from one of the public schools. And since 1996, we've had this informal relationship with that school, primarily because we shared so many students. About 75% of the kids at Generation Excel, which is the youth center, come out of that school. About 40% or so of the youth group kids at the church come out of that school. So we've had this informal relationship, but formalizing it was always so difficult because we were always volunteer driven. And your volunteers turn over, you know, you've got all the issues, all the reasons. So as much as we wanted to formalize a relationship, it didn't happen. And so, but the informal relationship was like, you know, limited student intervention. So sometimes there might be a kid that was just really acting up and the school was beside themselves. And if they happened to know the relationship with us, they might call us and we'd be part of like the group mediation with this student, right? That didn't happen very often. We would introduce ourselves to the principal and the parent coordinator. But again, because we were volunteer or part-timers, you know, that only went but so far. But the pastor did get invited to speak at commencement twice. So that was kind of cool. But beyond that, there really wasn't a whole lot going on. But then the youth pastor had a paradigm shift. In 2005, right? This was not me, the new youth pastor. And his shift was this, right? We're an inner city church. He was working full time, but getting paid way too little. Does that resonate real well? Right? So, but anticipating engagement and knowing that if he was going to get married, he was going to have to do right by the family, and being full time at the church was not going to do that for the family. And so he had a paradigm shift in 05, which was, let me see if I could get hired by the school that's sending most of the kids to our youth center and to my youth group. That way the school will pay me a lot better than the church, and I'll have more interaction with the school. And so he goes after it. In New York, they have this fellowship program for people changing professions. So the city thought that was a career change. He's thinking this is just an extension of ministry, but the city perceived it as a career change. So he went after it. He applied. He got the fellowship. Then after getting the fellowship, he had to now get hired by the school. So he goes and the school hires him to be a math teacher. Before he ever taught a day in his life in the classroom, last summer the principal calls him up and says, Jonathan, we have this new position. You know how with No Child Left Behind, school started doing funny math? Right? You know No Child Left Behind, if you underperform for 3 years, then there's all kinds of repercussions. So the way the cities handle that is in the third year of underperformance, they just change the school structure. So now they take one school and make three, and they hire two more principals. And now the same building, which has underperformed for so long, you got three brand new schools with no track record. So anyway, they kind of game the system. Well, the school had done that, and they had split the school into two different schools. And for the middle school, they had a new position of a dean. And they said, John, because of your work in the community with Excel and with the church, we think you'd be a great candidate to be the dean. So they hired him to be the dean. Then also the same summer, the missions director at the church, who's a product of the youth ministry, who before becoming a teacher was on staff at Generation Excel and a youth leader at the church, she's been teaching in a school in Brooklyn. So she has this epiphany and she says, let me apply to that school too. So she got hired to be a teacher in the school. So we went from 10 years of trying to figure out how do we partner with the school, not being resourced to be able to do it effectively because of the volunteer nature of what we were doing, to now the school hired the youth pastor to be its dean and the missions director to be a junior high math teacher. And so they're both in the school on an ongoing basis. And that's just elevated the relationship to the point where now the pastor of the church, he doesn't have to wait for commencement to be a guest. He's got like free entree to go and walk the hallways and pray and to talk to the kids. And because so many of the kids have been part of Excel in the church, they all recognize him. So he goes in there and, you know, they get all excited and the teachers get excited. And now this summer, this is only the first year. It's a complete experiment. But this summer, they've invited us in to do one of these Paint the Town projects. And so we're going into the school, we're going to paint, we're going to plant gardens, we're going to do all this stuff, and it's just beginning to unfold. We're so early in the relationship, but the point of the matter is, it began for us with the paradigm shift. Stop thinking about the school as an enemy. Stop thinking of it, you know, as if they're undermining what we're trying to do with our kids. Start engaging in it in relationship, beginning with prayer, right? Prayer doesn't sound like much. You're not doing, you're actually doing quite a bit. And so we've been praying for the school, and now the school is paying the youth director, the youth pastor, and the missions director far better than the church ever could. And their entree is not only with the students, but also with the families. So those are just two examples. There are lots of others that I could give you, but two very different approaches to how it got started. But I would encourage you to begin with the paradigm shift. Begin with the prayer, and then let's put God to the test. Let's put Him to the test. Because he says if we humble ourselves and pray and seek his face, what happens? He'll heal the land. So let's do it. Let's open it up. I've talked for way too long. Let me just say before we, I'm going to open this up hopefully for some brainstorming and conversation. But everything that you saw here is available online. So you can download the PowerPoint. You know, again, it's just a framework. If you're not from New York, I understand the particulars, the numbers might not be the same. But just to how to think about it, you know, if it's useful to you, feel free to check it out. You might have seen this on your seat this morning in the main auditorium. That's actually a mural in one of our centers, a theater. But this is the website, jeremydelrio.com, so you can go online and check that out. I also wanted to show you this. This is not my product, although I contributed to it. Student Venture, some of you might know, they're the High School Ministry of Campus Crusade. They've been in New York for a while, and they asked me to help them do some commentary for campus ministry. And I'm not a Campus Crusade person, so none of my commentary was like specific to that. And so at the end of it, they decided to self-publish it as a little book. And it's a paradigm for how to engage campuses. And it tells that whole story of Jesus and all that we started. So if you think that might be useful, check that out. And then this, the Journal of Student Ministries, one of the articles in there is Jesus Justice, So Easy a Five-Year-Old Can Do It. And it tells this story, but from a different through a different lens. And so those are some resources. I don't have handouts to give out, but you're free to take it, use it, you know, mush it up and make it your own, however you need to do that. But I do want to open up now for some feedback, some thoughts. In New York, there's a network, similarly a network of youth workers that meets on an ongoing basis. And a lot of the thinking that I've shared today has come out of that network and a very collaborative approach to thinking, you know, beyond the box of our particular churches on how we reach 2 million young people. So it's this overwhelming task, but God's called us to it. And so collectively we're trying. Now, how that's translating for us, it's been trying to communicate the message as widely as we can. And so the more churches we get praying, that's the lead, right? The conviction is if you pray, God's going to tug at your heart. And so begin there, which is more than many churches historically have even done. And then this has only been a year and a couple months since we started trumpeting it. And already the denomination, you know, the Southern Baptist group is moving in this direction. Individual congregations are starting to move into this direction. So we're early on in the experiment. I can't give you lots of great, you know, data at this stage because it's very early in it, but significant strides have been made. And so I would encourage you, you know, if there is, you said Chicago, connecting with some of the people in Chicago and getting them on the same page. Historically, yes. Now, this new deal, this entree into the school is new. And so this is the first, this summer will be the first time where a mass number of volunteers are actually going to be doing work within the school. But within the community, as I said, Excel is right across the street from the school. There's a park adjacent to the school. And so as a church, we've been ministering there for years. Basketball tournaments, carnivals, block parties, after school programs, summer camp programs. So there, and for that, the church has always provided lots of volunteers. So now the real excitement is that we're actually in the building and have this ongoing relationship with the kids and with the families. Any other thoughts or questions? How receptive are the schools to, I'm repeating it for the audio, the schools to having them come in? Frankly, and again, in our limited experience, the schools are very receptive. You know, if the churches have shifted the paradigm, if the churches are coming in to criticize and point fingers, then they get real defensive. If the churches are coming in solely to have like altar calls and evangelistic rallies, you know, that's a non-issue, a non-starter. Don't even waste your time. So if the churches are coming in, though, with a posture that says, we want to serve, we want to support, how can we help? Where that has been the posture, we've seen great receptivity. And, you know, like the one in the Crossroads thing, even something as simple as the teacher appreciation breakfast. You know, it wasn't like they had kitchen. It wasn't a hot meal. It was bagels and coffee and donuts. And the teachers were so appreciative of that. And there was no proselytizing. There was no, you know, like theological reflections or mandatory prayer or anything like that. It was just a relational way to minister and be nice. And God is, you know, taking it to a whole nother level for them. Let me give you another example, though, that I think speaks to that. I said before, this is not an original idea. So none of us take credit or ownership for it. An example or testimony that I've heard recently, though, comes out of Dallas, Tony Evans' ministry. Evidently, and you know, I've only heard the story retold, but evidently their church was in close proximity to some of the worst public high schools in Dallas. They were chronically underperforming schools, chronic violence, all the negative statistics, you know, were glaring. And so the principal of the school approached the pastor of the church, said, we need help. You know, it's not fair to the kids. We're tapped. We don't have any more ideas. We need help. And so that church figured out a way, and they're a mega church, so they had, you know, access to thousands of volunteers. But they figured out a way to get men from the church to volunteer to rotate in shifts. So they would come during their lunch break, or if they could get out of work a little early or go into work a little bit late. They created this system where men from the church would come and simply walk the hallways as a male presence and hallway monitors. And over the course of one academic year, the change in the crime rates and the performance measures was so dramatic that the principal of the school got promoted to district superintendent, right? So she came back to the church and she said, you know, this is why I got promoted. It clearly worked in the school. Can we do it on a district-wide level? Again, they're so large, they figured out a way to get these volunteers into 15 schools. And the numbers continued to show improvement. So she got promoted statewide. And their motto became a state thing in Texas, a state adopt a school initiative, which is now being championed nationally as well. But the point was, regarding volunteers, when you've got bivocational people, sometimes we got to think way beyond the box. You know, for the youth pastor I was talking about before, for him, it literally meant changing jobs to get into the school. Now, that's not realistic for everybody. But within a church, if the culture of the church is a passionate prayer for a school, you know, then God, I believe, and this might just be the Pentecostal side of me, that God answers prayer and that He opens our eyes to see things we didn't see before. And for us, it was this Teaching Fellows program, which had been around for a long time. And suddenly became this opportunity because our eyes had opened to it. And so things become a little bit more clear. I wish I could give a formula for it, but I really can't, other than to say if that's your heart and that's your passion, God's going to make a way for it to be possible. But it begins with that focused prayer. Great question and vitally important. And I think one of the things, you know, it begins, like this is just the tip of the iceberg as far as I'm concerned. When churches recognize their responsibility to engage, right, that's the first step. And historically, that hasn't been the paradigm for church engagement. So just getting people to understand there's a moral imperative, a biblical mandate to be present and a viable influence within those institutions. That's the first step. Once you're in that place, I believe God gives us eyes to see the issues that He's equipped us to address. And so for some of us, it's that justice advocacy. You know, it's the lobbying for systemic change. It's all of those kinds of things. And I would say if that's what God has shown you to do, to run with that now. Don't wait for permission to become a voice for the voiceless, because that's the passion. And that passion gets introduced into this kind of conversation, and other people hear that testimony and say, well, if they're doing it effectively in the South Bronx, how can I link arms with them and do it more effectively in Brooklyn or in Chicago or in Dallas or wherever people find themselves? So I would say, you know, on a macro level, it begins with getting our eyes off of the church and the boxy sort of paradigms of youth ministry we've had. So get beyond the walls of that institution, start thinking and praying and engaging and developing relationship. And then as that happens, when God gives us eyes to see, we've got to be obedient to respond. When He gives us ears to hear the heartbeat of those kids that are dropping out, you know, because of the failures of the school system, to be their champion and engage with them, I think that's the kind of thing that you don't delay. You know, if God tells you to start moving now, you've got to be obedient to that.